Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, October 13th, 2022. Early voting starts October 24th. Art by Crow Crumbs by Mary Cantrell, October 12th, 2022, 7:31 p.m. Tri-County. Early voting for the November 8th general election starts soon on Monday, October 24th, and runs weekdays through Friday, November 4th, with a number of polling locations throughout the Big Bend region. Voters across Texas will elect state leaders, including the governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, comptroller, land commissioner, and agriculture commissioner, who all serve four-year terms. Members of the Railroad Commission, who regulate the state's oil and gas industry, among other duties, are up for election for six-year terms. District-based representatives, including U.S. representatives, state senators, state representatives, and members of the state of education, are up for election. Local positions, including county judge, county commissioners, county treasurer, and more, are also up for election. Citizens must bring a valid form of identification to polling places when voting. Valid forms of ID include a Texas driver's license, Texas election ID certificate, Texas personal ID card, Texas handgun license, U.S. military ID with photo, U.S. citizenship certification with photo, or a U.S. passport. Voters without one of the acceptable listed forms of identification may still be able to vote. More information can be found at the Secretary of State's website. To vote by mail, citizens must request a ballot from the Secretary of State's office by October 28th. Ballots must be postmarked or delivered to their local county's elections office by 7 p.m. November 8th. Voter registration ended October 11th. To see if you are registered to vote, visit the Secretary of State's website. Presidio County. Early voting in Presidio County will take place from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. October 24th through November 4th at the Marfa Visitors Center / USO Building and the Presidio County Annex Building C. Both locations will serve residents in Precincts 1 through 7, or all Presidio County residents, for early voting. On Election Day, November 8th, polling locations throughout Presidio County will be open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. The Marfa Visitor Center will serve residents from Precincts 1 and 7. The Presidio Activity Center will serve Precinct 2 voters. The Presidio County Annex Building C will serve Precincts 3 and 4 voters. The American Legion in Presidio will serve Precinct 5 and 7 voters. Sample ballots will be posted on the county website soon, according to the county clerk. Local positions on the ballot include county judge, for which incumbent Cinderella Guevara, who switched parties during last December's candidate filing period to run as a Republican, face off against Democrat Jose Portillo Jr. The race for County Commissioner Precinct 4 will see Democrat David Beebe run against Republican Gary Wilbanks. County Commissioner Precinct 2 is an uncontested race, with Democrat Margarito Hernandez, who also serves as Presidio's police chief, the only candidate having beat out Abel Billy Hernandez in the primary election. Justice of the Peace Precinct 1 Democrat Dina Jo Marquez will run unopposed, as will Justice of the Peace Precinct 2 incumbent Democrat Juanita Urias Bishop. The race for county treasurer will see incumbent Democrat Francis Garcia, who was sued for alleged retaliation by former employee Katie Sanchez, a legal battle which ultimately cost the county $700,000 in a settlement, run against Republican David Chavez. Incumbent Democrat Florcita Subia is running for district/county clerk unopposed. Voters within the boundaries of the Marfa Independent School District will also see a school bond initiative on the ballot, a $57 million proposal for a new K-12 school, career and technology addition to the high school, and other district-wide improvements. The district will raise school property taxes to pay off the bond within a period of 30 years. The Big Bend Sentinel will continue its coverage of the school bond and publish candidate questionnaires for select races in Presidio County ahead of early voting. Brewster County. Early voting in Brewster County will take place at the Judge Val Clark Beard Office Complex, Old Library, 203 North 7th Street, Alpine. Hours will be 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday, October 24th, and Monday, October 31st. Hours will be 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. Tuesday, October 25th, through Friday, October 28th, and Tuesday, November 1st, through Friday, November 4th. Remote early voting will take place from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. November 2nd and 3rd at the Marathon Community Center for Precinct 3 residents. The Panther Junction Visitor Center, Big Bend National Park for Precinct 5 residents, and J.W. Red Patillo Community Center, Terlingua, for Precinct 6 and 7 residents. On Election Day, November 8th, voting will take place from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Precinct 1 voters can cast their ballots at the Assembly of God Fellowship Hall, across from Alpine High School, 1802 North Highway 118, Alpine. Precinct 2 voters can cast their ballots at the Judge Val Clark Beard Office Complex, Old Library, 203 North 7th Street, Alpine. Precinct 3 voters can cast their ballots at the Marathon Community Center, 2nd and Avenue E, Marathon. Precinct 4 voters can cast their ballots at the Alpine Civic Center Council Chambers, 803 West Holland, Alpine. Precinct 5 voters can cast their ballots at the Panther Junction Visitor Center, Big Bend National Park. Precinct 6 and 7 voters can cast their ballots at the J.W. Red Patillo Community Center, Terlingua. And Precinct 8 voters can cast their ballots at the Food Pantry of Alpine, 933 East Gallego Avenue, Alpine. Notably, voters in Brewster County this year will select a new county judge, the county's top position, which presides over the Commissioner's Court. Republican Greg Hennington will face off against Democrat Oscar Cobos. County Commissioner Precinct 2 is a race between incumbent Democrat Sarah Colando and Republican Mark Chiles. That's spelled C-H-I-L-E-S. Justice of the Peace Precinct 2 will see Republican Paul Rashot running against Democrat Tim Releva, R-E-L-L-E-V-A. There are also Marathon ISD school board members up for election. All other races in Brewster County are uncontested. To view a sample ballot, visit brewstercountytx.com/vote/. Jeff Davis County. Early voting in Jeff Davis County will take place from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. weekdays from October 24th to November 4th at the Jeff Davis County District and County Clerk's Office, located in the County Courthouse on 111 North Front Street, Fort Davis. On Election Day, November 8th, voting will take place from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Precinct 1, 2, and 3 voters will cast their ballots at the Jeff Davis County Community Center, 601 East Cemetery Road, Fort Davis, Precinct 4 voters at the Valentine Community Building, North Main and 8th Street, Valentine, and Precinct 5 voters at the Davis Mountains Resort Baptist Church, 101 Broken Arrow Trail, Fort Davis. In Jeff Davis County, current County Judge Curtis Evans, a Republican, is running unopposed to continue his role. County Commissioner Precinct 2 is a race between incumbent Democrat Todd Jagger and Republican Roy Hurley. County Commissioner Precinct 4 is a race between incumbent Democrat Albert Miller and Republican Royce Laskoski. All other races in Jeff Davis County are uncontested. To view a sample ballot, visit co.jeffhyphen-davis.tx.us/page/jeffdavis.elections. 35th Annual Chinati Weekend enlivens Marfa with art and community. Chinati artist-in-residence Jesus Benavente's I'm Not Dancing, I'm Struggling to Survive was on display as part of the artist's open studio during Chinati Weekend. Photo by Alex Marks, courtesy The Artist. By Sam Karras, October 12, 2022. Marfa, this year's Chinati Weekend, an annual open house event thrown by the revered arts institution since 1987, saw tourists and locals alike mingling and enjoying everything local and visiting artists had to offer, Friday through Sunday. An estimated 800 people gathered in the Chinati Arena for Saturday night's free community dinner, a yearly tradition started by founder Donald Judd. The main focus of the celebration each year is the museum's collections, which are open for self-guided touring. Typically, visitors have to sign up for a tour to view everything in the collection. It's the one time a year we can wander around Chinati at our own pace, curator Ingrid Scheffner said. The weekend's festivities kicked off with Made in Marfa, highlighting local artists and craftsmen. Old-school Marfa institutions like the Wrong Store, Binder Gallery, and Ballroom Marfa opened their doors for festive openings alongside relative newcomers like JEFF, Art Blocks, and Maintenance. Marfa-based artist Cody Barber showed a piece at Problem Gallery, a DIY pop-up space curated by Brendan Sicoria. Barber has had a presence in the local art scene for years. His powder-coated horseshoes and crushed can sculptural works are a staple at local shops and galleries. The inaugural opening at Problem gave Barber the opportunity to show work alongside freshly minted artists and to mingle with a diverse group of people. A very mixed crowd came through, a nice mix of locals and tourists, business owners, people of all ages, he said. The overall energy is one I haven't felt since the pandemic. Barber had hoped to host his own open studio as part of Made in Marfa, but got swamped with commissions and other projects before he could make adequate preparations. Sicoria's invitation to show work alongside neighbors and friends was a welcome surprise. They really took a lot of stress off of the artists, Barber said. By stress, he meant the typical headaches of organizing a show, coordinating all of the promotion and the installation, and in Friday night's case, a booth serving nacho fries provided by Cloudy's Desert Bistro. In a break with traditional gallery culture, the artists were encouraged to list their work for sale, with 100% of the proceeds going to the artist. Barber walked away from the experience feeling optimistic about the future of the local art scene. It just felt really innocent. I mean that, like pure in the face of what the art world can sometimes bring, he said. It was all about people who live here and what they can do, and that they deserve to share that with their community and with visitors. Other highlights of the weekend included an open studio with Chinati artist-in-residence Jesus Benavente and an opportunity for visitors to view a commissioned work by Sarah Crowner titled Platform, Blue Terracotta for J.C. On Saturday, Schaffner interviewed Crowner at the Crowley Theater to a packed house. She was so generous with all that she shared, Schaffner said. Another highlight for many attendees was a show of photographs by John Chamberlain, whose sculptures are an integral part of the Chinati collection and a part of the largest single installation of his work in the world. I think these photographs are real news to people, Schaffner said. Guests, in particular, were particularly fond of a photograph posed in a hotel bathroom. Who knew Chamberlain invented the bathroom selfie? Schaffner has curated the world-renowned museum since 2020. Her first Chinati weekend was also the first Chinati weekend hosted completely online. Last year, many still made the pilgrimage, but pandemic precautions put a damper on a lot of the usual festivities. There was so much vitality, Schaffner said to sum up the weekend. It really felt like we're back up to speed. The Judd Foundation sues galleries over permanent fingerprint damage to $850,000 aluminum sculpture by Mary Cantrell, October 12, 2022. Manhattan. The Judd Foundation is suing companion galleries Tina Kim, based in New York, and Kukje, K-U-K-J-E, based in Seoul, over irreversible damage an aluminum Donald Judd sculpture incurred while in their possession, according to court documents filed last week in New York Supreme Court. The work, untitled 1991, is part of the late artist's Menziken series, a roughly 9-by-39-inch rectangular sculpture made of anodized aluminum and acrylic, which was disfigured by fingerprints, according to the written complaint brought against the galleries. The suit, in which the Judd Foundation is arguing the galleries committed breach of contract, was originally filed in Texas, but was dismissed over jurisdictional issues. According to court documents, the anodized aluminum surface of the sculpture requires careful, gloved handling, and the fingerprints, which were not swiftly addressed by an art conservator, led to irreversible damage. Any fingerprints on the anodized aluminum surface must be removed quickly, or over time the oils in the fingerprints can react with the surface and leave permanent, disfiguring, irreversible marks, the lawsuit claims. In an interview with the Big Ben Sentinel, objects conservator Megan Perry confirmed human fingerprints can cause permanent damage to such an artwork if left untreated. Metals like copper, steel, and aluminum are highly reactive, she said, making them susceptible to oils, salts, and acids contained in human fingerprints. For example, a person loading a bullet into a gun for mere seconds may leave a traceable fingerprint that can later be used for forensic purposes, she said. No one's wiped off these oils, so they've had time to just really affect the surface of the metal. They eat through the oxide layer on the aluminum, that passivating film that protects it and keeps it from corroding, making it susceptible to environmental attack in a way that it would not normally be if no one had touched it, said Perry. The work, which cost $850,000, was originally loaned to the Tina Kim and Kukje galleries, operated by members of the same family, in 2015, in order to be sold. The Judd Foundation selects from time to time certain sculptures considered ancillary to its core collection to offer for sale to help support the foundation's mission, according to the lawsuit. The Judd Foundation released the sculpture from its location at a moving and storage company in Switzerland in 2015, then entered into two consecutive consignment renewals with the galleries until ultimately terminating the agreement in 2018. During that time, Untitled 1991 traveled to the Freeze Art Fair in New York, to Art Basel Miami Beach, and to Abu Dhabi to be shown at the gallery's joint booths, but never sold. The sculpture was then sent back to the Judd Foundation in Marfa, where a conservator noticed the damage upon uncrating. While it was on loan, the work passed through art storage companies, which perform routine condition reports upon an object's arrival and departure, to note any relevant damages for insurance purposes and more. Three separate condition reports, one from 2017 and two from 2018, detailed fingerprints on the work, but the Judd Foundation was never notified. The consignment agreement held the galleries responsible for the cleaning and conservation of the work while in its possession. That should be conservation of the work while in its possession, with the stipulation that the Judd Foundation provide written consent for any conservation treatment. The consignment agreements stated the Kukji Gallery would be held responsible for any possible damage to the work, including any compensation not covered by its insurance company. To date, its insurance company has paid 80% of the cost of the damages, or $680,000, but the galleries still owe a remaining sum of $170,000. The foundation is also seeking an additional $100,000 to cover attorney's fees and interest. The market value of the work has now increased to $950,000, the lawsuit claims.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading for Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, October 13th, 2022. Interactive Classroom Panels Approved by Sean Yorks. Students across the Fort Stockton ISD will soon reap the benefits of last May's bond election with updated classroom technology. The FSISD met in a six-minute special meeting October 6th to discuss a proposal from SHI for interactive flat screens for the school district's classrooms. One of the things that we wanted to address in our classrooms are the old technologies that we have as far as projectors and smart boards that are outdated and in some cases are not even serviceable, said Superintendent Zamora. Mr. Roy Alvarado has been working with all the campuses and has arrived at what they believe is the solution for years to come for each of our classrooms. The technology was part of School Proposition D, which was approved by voters last May. The $3 million proposition was one of five on the ballot, but was the only one approved by voters. The district purchased 181 of the screens and 164 rolling carts, along with associated service agreements and training, at a cost of just under $817,000. Each of these units that are being purchased will have its own brain. In other words, its own computer that is attached to the interactive touchscreen, 86 inches, and comes with an adjustable cart that they can lower and raise so that it works for every appropriate age. They decided to go with this rather than mount it on the wall because the teachers wanted to maintain the flexibility of rearranging their classroom. We can afford this again because of the good people of Fort Stockton pushed through that $3 million bond, and I think this is going to be a great tool for the classroom, a great motivator. Alvarado said the items can be delivered as soon as possible and be in the classrooms by November. Hail Mageddon. Storm causes FISD closure and hospital flooding. By Nathan Hewer. A mix of significant hail and rainfall on Monday evening caused the closure of school on Tuesday and flooding at Pecos County Memorial Hospital. The National Weather Service in Midland reported that Fort Stockton received 2 to 3 inches of precipitation during the rare weather event. a meteorologist in Midland, gave context to the storm and why it caused flooding in many areas locally. One of the things we were noticing and why the flooding could have been so substantial, it wasn't just the veracity of the rain, it was also the fact that there was so much hail that was falling during that time frame that it probably had a lot of blockage in a lot of drainage areas. That caused everything to back up, and then it just snowballs from there. The meteorologist added that the event was set up by elevated levels of moisture in the atmosphere, something that is extremely rare for this time of year. In general, an event like that is fairly rare. We don't see hailstorms like that very often in this location. I think the one thing that was the kicker was how much moisture was in the atmosphere during the day. It was approaching the 90th percentile in climatology for the amount of precipitable water. The area was at 1.3 inches, which is a lot for this time of year. The extensive accumulation caused by the rainfall and blockage of drains caused flooding at Fort Stockton High School and Apache Elementary. Superintendent Gabriel Zamora informed local media and the public of the district's closure on Tuesday, just after 7:30 p.m. on Monday, an hour and a half after the storm started in Fort Stockton and shortly after it left the area. I decided to cancel it 35 to 40 minutes after it started coming down, as soon as I went out on some campuses and saw what was going on. I wanted to give people as much of a heads up as I could, because I know some people count on the school for daycare. I don't need people to pull in an all-nighter, potentially hurt themselves or slip with electricity to get our campuses prepared for Tuesday. The school staff hired contractors were able to act quickly at the campuses on Tuesday and prevent significant damage. As a result, campuses across the district reopened on Wednesday for all students. Fixtures and renovations that will be made this week include the replacement of carpet in areas that were affected by flooding in the old wing of Apache and roof leaks that impacted numerous campuses. There were new leaks that were identified, and we started a share drive to consolidate the fixtures needed by campuses. The ones that were impacted the most were Apache and the high school, but none of them came out completely clean. We have a tremendous maintenance staff, and they were able to get the campuses prepared for school within a day. Fort Stockton ISD will absorb the cost of fixtures via fund balance despite having insurance coverage of all campuses. Zamora said that each campus has a $150,000 to $200,000 deductible, which is well below the cost associated with storm damage. At Pecos County Memorial Hospital, the community rallied to ensure the safety of patients and the facilities that provide health care to those in need. PCHS CEO reported that over 95 community members, including employees of the hospital, city and county staff, and students at the school, helped clean up flooded areas. We want to express our sincere appreciation to our community and our employees. We had over 95 people pumping, pushing, and mopping the flood water last night. You all are amazing, and we are truly blessed, Briscoe said. At Tuesday's commissioners meeting, Briscoe added context to the damage done to PCMH. Basically, pretty much every patient room had water seeping in under the foundation and coming into the patient rooms, some of it all the way into the hallways. It took us a couple of hours to get most of the water pushed back out. We removed all the patients out of the rooms. Surgery was not flooded, so patients were moved to that area. The facility had fans set up to dry the floor as of Tuesday afternoon. Our brand new flooring, a lot of it is going to have to be replaced. We did have to cancel a couple of surgeries because we didn't have time to get the rooms cleaned. Officials urge Texans to get flu vaccination. Flu season is underway, and the health officials are urging Texans to get their vaccines as soon as possible, since it takes about 2 weeks for the shot to take effect. Because the flu can be a very serious disease, we recommend that all individuals aged 6 months and older get a flu vaccine every year. The flu vaccines for the 22-23 flu season have undergone substantial changes since last season, which will allow them to better protect against the flu viruses that are currently circulating. So it's important to go get the vaccine before the activity increases even more in Texas. People over the age of 65 have a choice of 3 different recommended higher doses, which are considered more effective for this age group. People can also safely get a COVID-19 vaccine or booster at the same time. Flu shots are widely available. To find out where, go to vaccines.gov. Colorful fall foliage looks unlikely. With much of the state still abnormally dry or in some stage of drought, trees across the state are struggling with the effects of high temperatures and little rain. That means there's likely this year's fall foliage won't be as vivid as usual. Many trees put on fewer, smaller leaves this spring or started to change color or prematurely dropped their leaves in the summer. All of this will most likely lead to fall colors that are less impressive than in years past. Deciduous trees drop their leaves in the autumn to conserve energy. However, due to the drought, some trees have already dropped their leaves before the green chlorophyll begins breaking down, which is what results in the fall colors. Other trees still have their leaves, but they've already turned dead and brown. There are other long-term effects from drought besides a lack of pretty colors, including a higher vulnerability to wood-borne insects. It could take months to determine the ultimate toll from the drought on the state's trees. More than $329 million in emergency food benefits are being extended by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program for October, marking 30 straight months of additional benefits. All SNAP households will receive a minimum of $95 in emergency allotments in addition to their regular benefits. About 1.6 million Texas households benefit from the allotments. More than $8.2 billion in emergency benefits have been provided by USA to Texans since April 2020. HHSC is proud to continue helping Texas who need a helping hand to put food on the table. Film Society presents the Rocky Horror Picture Show. The Fort Stockton Film Society will host a free Halloween night screening of the Rocky Horror Picture Show on October 31st at 7 p.m. The screening will be a participatory film along with free popcorn and free admission, courtesy of the Fort Stockton Association for the Support of Local Arts and Music. There will also be a $50 prize for the best costume and a classic cartoon shown just before the main feature. Because it was a box office flop when it came out in 1975, the Rocky Horror Picture Show is considered a cult film. It gained new fans when it started being shown at midnight movie screenings around the country in the late 70s. Fans began to talk back to the screen and bring props for the showings, including newspapers to hold over their heads during the rain segments. As one fan put it, this is such a kishkiness and campiness to it that you can't help but have a little fun with such a bad movie. A complete guide to how to participate and any banned props are provided on the Film Society website. The film is filled with catchy tunes like The Time Warp that was reenacted on an episode of the hit TV series Glee. The movie also marked early screen appearances for Academy Award-winning actress Susan Sarandon and the singer Meatloaf, who plays Eddie, well before his Bat Out of Hell LP became a hit. Leading man Barry Bostwick also later went on to star in the TV sitcom Spin City. The movie carries an R rating. Even though it is billed as a musical comedy, it contains scenes and dialogue that are not suitable for young children. Doors will open at 6:30 at the Nelson Theater, located at 102 South Nelson. Donations will be accepted. For more information and an audience guide to participatory film watching, visit FortStocktonFilmSociety.org. Living History Days is October 21st and 22nd by Sean Yorks. Local history will come alive once again at the annual Living History Days, October 21st, 22nd, at the Annie Riggs Museum. The event has been taking place for decades, but this will be the first for director Ross Harper. It's going to be a super fun, Harper said. Living History Days is something the Historical Society has done at the fort for decades, and in recent past, it's only been a one-day event for the Fort Stockton kids. But we're opening it up for 2 days because it's now been a decade since the town got to enjoy it. Students from Fort Stockton, Imperial, Sanderson, and Balmoray will take over the museum on Friday, October 21st, and the general public will be able to experience the displays and demonstrations the following day from 9 to 4. The main attraction for the kids will be the U.S. Camel Corps. Back in the 1850s, there was a small experiment to bring camels to the west as pack animals. They experimented for a couple of years, and there were camels here in Fort Stockton. There were camels in Fort Davis and throughout the west. Camels were successful in some regards, but were not able to overtake mules and horses as traditional pack animals, and the project was abandoned by the beginning of the Civil War. As a result, apparently for a decade or so, there were loose camels just kind of roaming around out here. They gave up the program and they just let them go. Today, the Camel Corps travels to various events to explain the story of the Corps, but the camels aren't all that's going to be at the museum. Buffalo Soldier reenactors, spinners, cavalry skins and skulls, flint napping, a blacksmith shop, laundresses, cannons, a chuck wagon, 19th century games are all part of the show. We've seen 7 African-American men from San Antonio who are part of a Buffalo Soldier program, and they're coming out and they're going to be discussing the history of the Buffalo Soldiers. We have in total about 50 reenactors who will be in costume. Harper hopes people from surrounding towns will come to Fort Stockton for the Saturday events. And Sanderson's Ken Beauchamp will be in a concert on Friday, October 21st, for a return engagement after performing here last April and July. He was so popular, we brought him back. The concert at the fort will take place from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. The last few years, it's been smaller with a dozen reenactors, but this year, we've beefed it up.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahan News for Thursday, October 6th. Plans for a new $14 million Kids Zone facility underway. The story was written by Jan Crenfield. A new youth activity center for the Monahan's Kids Zone, formerly the Boys and Girls Club, a nonprofit branch of Ward County Greater Works, Ector County Greater Works, and Midland County Greater Works, is coming to Monahan's. This fourth facility of WCGW will be known as Monahan's Kids Zone. The new youth facility will be located across from Parkway Elementary in the East Monahan subdivision. Quote, "The current building has long outlived its usefulness. We checked into repairing and updating the current place, but it actually was going to cost as much to do upgrade and repair as building a completely new place," Board Vice President and Ward County Facilities Supervising Board Member Brian Heflin said. According to a grant proposal, the new MKZ will be an after-school and part-time summer facility. MKZ will serve students in 1st through 6th grade with tutors, after-school homework assistance, healthy food and snacks. Also, a place to play with adult supervision in case of emergency. A secure bus stop will allow students from all other campuses to be bused and travel safely to the new MKZ. Plans are to expand services to include high school students through 12th grade. The new MKZ building will also house the Lobo Learning Center, which will provide after-school mentoring, reading, tutoring, and homework programs along with a computer lab. The Lobo Learning Center will utilize modes such as interactive software that will allow a student to track their reading ability progress. The digital literacy program will enable students to keep pace with developments in technology and help them be competitive and better understand the workforce at large. Quote, "Specifically, the mission for Monahan's Kids Zone is to invest in the youth of today for a better tomorrow. We want to educate, inspire, and develop," Heflin said. Monahan's Economic Development Corporation, MEDC, along with the City of Monahan's and Ward County, have worked together to put in the necessary infrastructure for the new facility. MEDC will donate 2 acres of land to have the new MKZ building in a perfect location across from the Parkway Elementary, and the county will clear and clean the land. Quote, "We are working with several entities, private fundraisers, city and county, to ensure that the best possible plans are made for the facility," Heflin said. Grants, fundraisers, and donations are funding the project, and at this time, the project funds stand at $3 million. The project cost comes in around $14 million, and Heflin said he hopes it will be completed and operation by fall of 2024. Quote, "Our goal is to have the full amount raised by the time construction begins, but we are considering options to begin sooner. The project could be in phases, with the gym being phase two, starting later once the balance of funds are raised," said Heflin. Parkhill, an architectural and engineering firm, the same firm overseeing the school bond project, has completed the design and floor plan renderings. Upcoming scheduled Kids Zone fundraisers include the West Texas Barbecue Bash and Car Show, slated for Saturday, October 15th. A full schedule for the event will be published in the news next week. A golf tournament, Teeing It Up for Kids, hosted by Atlas Sand on Saturday, October 22nd, also details in the Monahan's news next week. The Gingerbread Jubilee in December, details to be supplied at a later date. And the annual Hog Ranch Christmas Party Kids Zone fundraiser, hosted by Dusty Colston, which was the fundraiser that set plans in motion for the new facility. Quote, "Monahan's Kids Zone has always had a special place in my heart. As a single mom with four kids working at Kent Quick convenience store, struggling to pay my rent, I had to have child care, but couldn't afford it. I don't know what I would have done without this program's existence. When the idea of fundraising came up, I was catering to a sand plant at the time and delivered what was left over to the Kids Zone in order to feed the kids after school. I noticed the old computers and how hot the building was and started questioning and asking what we could do to fix that issue. Brian informed me that he didn't even know if the program was going to have the funds to stay open after the end of that year. In the past, I had held annual Hog Ranch Christmas parties and had one planned for that year, so I decided at the last minute to turn it into a fundraiser with all the proceeds going to the Kids Zone. That first year, we raised $45,000, and so the annual event began. I feel as though this program is important to the community to give a safe place for kids to go after school and in the summer months. There are a lot of parents in the same position I was when my children attended the program. It is truly of the utmost importance to me for this program to not only continue to exist in the community, but also to expand and grow so that our children in this community may benefit from all that it has and will have to offer, Colson said. The Kids Zone Entity Committee consists of Brian Heflin, Teresa Burnett, Nancy Prieto, Eddie Nelms, Ashley Adalto, Rex Thee, Marie Chavez, Brett Heflin, Brenda Kizier, Chad Smith, and Jeff Jones. The Ward County Greater Works Incorporated Governing Board of Directors are Kay Ellis of Midland, Brian Heflin, Mark Peterson of Midland, Donna Belt of Odessa, Darlena Rush of Odessa, Teresa Burnett, Larry Brown of Midland, Nancy Prieto, and Sherry Bailey of Odessa. Plan continues for sticker ant problems at cemetery. Removal of plot violations begins. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. In response to the recent complaint regarding the condition of the city cemetery presented to the City Council during last week's meeting by Teresa Stoner Perry, City Manager Rex Thee provided the news with the city's weed, sand burr, and ant control plan, which has been in effect since 2018. During the meeting, Stoner told the council the cemetery was shameful and disgusting, providing pictures of the overgrown weeds on the sidewalks, the multitude of sand burrs, overgrown trees covering headstones, and even a veteran's headstone which had been knocked over and broken. Thee said, quote, the city is continuing to do everything we can to control the weed, sticker, and ant problem at the city cemetery. This plan has been in effect since 2018, and we still follow it." End quote. Director of Public Works Richard Covington took over the direction of the city cemetery last year, but told the news the city has faced staffing shortages within the last year, which has led to the plan not being followed as scheduled. Quote, "We have certain herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers which are put out on a monthly schedule. That has been the plan since 2018 and will continue to be the plan because it works. The same schedule is used for the city parks, which are looking great. The city has recently had several employees leave for jobs in the oil field, and we've had some retire," Covington said. The cemetery alone has lost two employees within the last month. Longtime cemetery employee Italicio Chaco Salazar retired a few weeks ago, and current cemetery supervisor Daniel Hernandez will end his tenure at the end of October. Quote, "I'm not trying to make excuses for the state of the cemetery, but if the citizens can just give me some time to get the plan back in motion, I know I can get the results we've seen at the city parks at the cemetery too," Covington said. The cemetery has seen plenty of shifts in employment over the last month. Most notable is the hiring of Victor Cano as the cemetery supervisor. Cano has worked for the city for the last 7 years, most recently in street maintenance. Quote, "Victor is currently in training and will officially take over on November 1st. We also have hired 4 new employees and 1 part-time employee for the cemetery, which will leave us pretty close to fully staffed," Covington added. The plan states the current herbicides in use are Pendulum, which is a spray pre- and post-emergent for sandburrs, Balon Surflon XL2G for stickers and broadleafs, Roundup Pro Power Max with careful application not to kill grass or trees, Trimex Southern for broadleafs and winter weeds, and Endrun for broadleafs, dandelions, clover, pigweed, goathead, etc. Current pesticide use, Fipronil Granular is being used for ant control. For fertilization, we use 16-8-8 for green up, root health, general plant health, he said. Quote, "There is a monthly schedule when each chemical is used, but due to unpredictable weather, wind, and park traffic, some of the days and chemical sprays will vary," he said. Going into the fall months, employees will apply Pendulum, Balan, and Fipronil to all areas along with some pre- and post-emergent. In 2018, the city recently purchased 2 new mowers with blower vacuum baggers, and in 2021, the city purchased a new self-propelled chemical sprayer with a 200-gallon tank capacity. Quote, "The equipment helps minimize sticker seed disbursement. The sprayer is 18 feet wide, and the vacuum bag catcher will catch most of the stickers when the grass is mowed," Covington said. Thee added, quote, "The herbicide plan will help a lot, but I don't think it will ever be foolproof," end quote. Covington has also recently sought out estimates to fix the veteran's headstone, which is broken since no relatives could be located. Along with the plan for weed and sticker control, the city has also begun the dauntless task of removing items from graves, which are in violation of the Monahans Memorial Cemetery regulations under the City of Monahans Code of Ordinances. Quote, "Anyone who buys a plot is given a copy of the regulations and the city code that clearly states the city has the right to remove and do away with any object or structure that does not meet city code," Covington said. In part, Section 7-25 and 7-26 of the Code Ordinances states, quote, "Lot owners shall not change the grade of any lot, nor interfere in any way with the general plan of the improvement of the cemetery. No fences will be permitted, and a grave covering preventing normal maintenance operations is prohibited. The biggest problem we're seeing is a lot of items spread throughout the plot and in the way of mowers, like the solar lights, rocks, and fences around plots, all of which are prohibited and need to be removed, he said. Covington added, plot owners are not allowed to place anything in the grass around the plot at all. Items can only be placed on the headstone. Cemetery employees began the removal on Tuesday and will continue until it is completed. Confiscated items will be held for 30 days, and anyone wanting to come claim items can do so at the cemetery between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. Anyone wanting to address the city council on the topics discussed in the story may do so by asking to be added to the meeting agenda in the city secretary's office located inside City Hall, or by appearing at the meeting during the public comment section of the meeting, which is on every agenda. City Council meets every second and fourth Tuesday at 3 p.m. in the council chambers at City Hall. The next meeting is Tuesday, October 11th. November 8th midterm elections. What you need to know. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Voters across the state of Texas are heading back to the polls on Tuesday, November 8th, for the 2022 midterm election. While there is no presidential election this year, eligible Texans can cast their ballots for state leaders and their district-based representatives. The governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, comptroller, land commissioner, and agriculture commissioner, who all serve four-year terms, are up for election. The most closely watched race this November is the race for the governor's seat. Republican Governor Greg Abbott is running for a third term and faces Democrat Beto O'Rourke. On the ballot locally for Ward County are judge, district clerk, treasurer, Commissioner Precinct 2, Commissioner Precinct 4, Justice of the Peace Precinct 2 and 3, and Justice of the Peace 1 and 4, although none of which are contested races. Statewide, along with the governor's race, the other contested race is for U.S. District 23, where incumbent Tony Gonzalez is facing John Lira and Frank Lopez Jr. Texas Senate District 31 candidate Kevin Sparks, who claimed that seat with over 54% of the vote during the primary election in March, will also be on the ballot without an opponent, along with incumbent Brooks Landgraf for Texas House District 81. The deadline to register to vote is October 11th. The last day to apply to vote by mail is October 28th. Early voting runs from October 24th to November 4th. Anyone wishing to vote early can do so at the Ward County Clerk's Office inside the Ward County Courthouse, located at 400 South Allen, Suite 101, between the hours of 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. On Election Day, the polls will be open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., and voters must vote in the precinct where they are registered to vote. Polling place for Precincts 1E, 2, 3N, and 4E will be the Ward County Event Center, located at 1525 East Monahans Parkway. Precinct 4M, Wicket, will vote at the Wicket Community Center, located at 501 O'Brien Street in Wicket. Precinct 4W, Pyote, will vote at the Pyote Community Center, located at 1108 North Ward Street in Pyote. Precinct 1W, Barstow, will cast their votes at the Barstow Community Center, located at 100 East Concho in Barstow. And finally, Precinct 3S, Grand Falls, will vote at the Grand Falls Community Center, located at 711 North A Street in Grand Falls. Applications for mail-in ballots must be received no later than the close of business on October 24th. Alleged gun threat at junior high determined to be rumor. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. Monahans Wicket Pyote Independent School District officials said they have investigated and found that a threat against the district and Walker Junior High School was not credible. The threat manifested late Monday night. In a prepared statement to the news, Superintendent of Schools Chad Smith said, quote, "Late last night, we were made aware of a threat that was made against MWP ISD and Walker Junior High specifically. The situation has been handled by school officials and law enforcement, and there is no threat at this time. Safety is our top priority at MWP ISD, and we feel it is safe to send your child to school," end quote. The investigation into the threat began allegedly after students at the junior high reported hearing about another student who threatened to bring a gun to school. Although Smith refused to comment on any facts of the case or if it was in fact a gun threat, posts of the alleged threat were making the rounds on the social media sites TikTok and Snapchat over the last few days. Before the end of business on Tuesday, Smith emailed the following statement, quote, "After further investigation by law enforcement, including the Midland Criminal Investigation Division, the threat against Walker Junior High is most likely a rumor. We are in the process of trying to identify who might have started the rumor. However, we do appreciate students coming forward as we take the safety of our students and staff very seriously. We will continue to monitor the situation," end quote.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.